I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. When it comes to the case of Missouri Governor Eric Greitens, the battle lines have been drawn, and each camp has dug in. On one side, Republican and Democratic lawmakers are calling for his resignation. On the other side, charges leveled against the governor amount to a political witch hunt. Today we discuss the legislative and judicial processes at work designed to keep the whole ordeal as fair as possible. Then a look at how media archivists are keeping Kansas City history alive at UMKC's Miller Nichols Library. We'll hear from those on the front lines about preservation efforts there and about the unique importance of audio archives. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. In the 43 years that Bob Priddy has been covering Missouri government, he's seen just about everything that Jeff City has to offer. Until now, the turmoil surrounding Governor Eric Greitens is something new. In a commentary last week, Bob reflected on what he calls the process, or the wheels of government, which will result in conviction or exoneration for this governor, impeachment, or the opportunity to complete his term in office. Bob Priddy was the news director of the Missouri Net Radio Network from its beginning in 1975 until his retirement in December 2014. He's written books on the Thomas Hart Benton mural in the Missouri House Lounge and other art in the Capitol. He's president of the State Historical Society of Missouri. Bob, it's always great to have you here. Welcome back.
Thank you, Steve. It's good to talk to you. It's been a while.
It has been a while. Too long.
Yeah.
You know, you wrote last week in this column about Governor Greitens. You said that this is a time of strong opinions, strong statements, and strong actions. In such times, it's important to recognize there is the process. What is the process, at least in your eyes?
In this case, I'm talking about the legal process. Mm-hmm. And when you come down to it, the legal process that determines the guilt or not guilt of someone who is accused of something strips away the politics and the emotions as much as possible and gets down to the facts, the information, and the capability of people to tell the truth and the evaluation of what is true by a jury of one's peers. All of this other stuff that's going on now in terms of demanding his mm-hmm. resignation or threatening to impeach him, that's a political issue. But you come down to the legal process that he now is facing with these two felony charges. And that's really the key. Is he guilty of a crime or not? And that's what the process is all about. That's what we go through. You and I, as well as the governor, should we be accused of something significant, we would go through this same process. And sometimes we get so wrapped up in the politics and the emotions of issues that we forget that it's really the process that determines guilt or not yeah. guilt. And I say not guilt because not guilty doesn't mean you're innocent. It just means the prosecution hasn't presented a case significant enough to convince a jury to find someone guilty. And we are all innocent until proven guilty in the eyes of the law. And sometimes, such as we're seeing now, it's kind of hard to remember that. Mm-hmm. There seems to be an assumption by a lot of people that Eric Greitens is indeed guilty of something. But the process hasn't worked its way through yet to determine that. And so we sometimes get carried away, I think, by some of the emotion and some of the politics of an issue. And in many ways, we're seeing that happen now.
KCUR listeners can read Bob Priddy's commentary at MissouriNet.com. Again, the headline of his piece is The Process. You know, as I mentioned, Bob, you've seen a lot during your years covering the State House. You said this: this observer has seen two speakers of the House and one attorney general sent to prison. He's seen a secretary of state impeached and removed from office. He's seen a state treasurer exonerated after being charged with profiting from state funds. He's covered criminal proceedings against at least 17 members of the House and three members of the Senate that resulted in convictions or guilty pleas to misdemeanors and to felonies. What makes the situation surrounding Governor Greitens different?
Well, first, he's the first governor who's ever faced criminal charges while in office. He is the first governor that I know of who has faced an impeachment proceeding while in office. And I'm enough of a historian that I've gone all the way back to the 1820s when we first had a governor, a state governor. And so I don't think this is the kind of situation that is enmeshing Eric Greitens that is unique in our state history. I might also mention that the process appears on my own personal blog, bobpretty.net. And I post something there at least once a week that has to do with government or history or things like that. So the process is available there, too. But this is a unique situation with Eric Greitens. We've never had anything like this before in our state's history, although we've had impeachments. The only other governor who was ever, in effect, removed from office was Caleb Jackson, Claiborne Fox Jackson, at the start of the Civil War. And he was the Confederate-leaning governor who, when General Nathaniel Lyon said that he was not going to let the governor of the state of Missouri dictate whether federal troops could come into Missouri, it was then that Jackson fled from St. Louis, where the meeting was held, went back to Jefferson City, called a late-night session of the legislature, and his loyalists in the legislature and others grabbed up whatever state records they could and fled to Boonville, where the first major Civil War confrontation took place in Missouri, the Battle of Boonville, which was such a failure for the Confederates that it was referred to as the Boonville Races. But nonetheless, once Jackson, in effect, left the Capitol, and left the state, he eventually went to Arkansas, then a convention that had been assembled to determine whether we should stay in the Union then held that he had basically abdicated the governorship, and an interim governor, Hamilton Gamble, was appointed to serve until the next election could be held to elect a governor. So that's the only time that we have had anything close to a governor being removed in state history in Missouri. And now we have this situation where Greitens is facing criminal charges and he is facing possible removal actions through the impeachment process in the legislature.
You know, Bob Pretty, no wonder that you're the president of the State Historical Society of Missouri. I mean, holy smokes. There's you and about three other people in the state know all that stuff.
Well, I think more than three, but thank you.
You've covered a lot of governors over the years. What distinguishes Governor Greitens from the others from your vantage point?
Well, this is not the first populist governor I've covered. You covered Joe Teasdale, and you remember Joe was a populist. From Kansas City. And he got into office by basically appealing to people on a populist basis, knowing he promised some things that he knew he could not do legally or economically in those days. And even though he was reminded by people like me and my reporters and people like you and other reporters that he was spouting, well, nonsense, to people who were affected by high utility rates and high inflation in those times, listened to his message, and they narrowly elected him over Christopher Bond, who came back 4 years later and beat him ten times worse because the things he promised he could do, he wasn't able to do. And he's not the first governor who has had trouble with his own party. In fact, I remember Bond had trouble with Republicans when he came in. You know, Christopher Bond was the youngest governor in Missouri history, and there were some of the crusty old legislators who didn't much like this whippersnapper coming in.
He sided with Gerald Ford in that big showdown between Ford and Reagan in 76.
That's right. In fact, he was on Ford's short list as a potential vice presidential candidate at the convention. And then in 1976, after the convention, he lost the race to Teasdale, which changed his political future quite a bit. But he came back and he won the governorship in 1980 and then went on to be a three-term U.S. senator. In fact, I saw him at Greitens' inauguration a year and a half or so ago.
Yeah. You make another interesting point in this column. You write that the report from the House committee that included testimony from the woman who's at the center of this affair with Governor Greitens, describing multiple incidents of violence, was two things at once. You said this: it's both devastating news for the governor and it's also valuable news to the governor. How can it be both?
Well, first of all, what she said about the governor and what the committee says they found to be credible because of other people who supported what she said, that's one thing. That's got to be really bad news for him. But at the same time, in terms of his court case, in terms of his defense in court, they now have what she said in a transcript on the record. And they now can know going into that courtroom what her testimony is, so they can be prepared to challenge it in any way they choose. And if she changes her testimony in the courtroom, that then could be a positive for the governor and a negative thing for her side. So this process that we had with her testifying before the committee and the committee reporting what she said, that can work both ways. Number one, in view of the legislative committee, that is pretty condemnatory. But in terms of his defense, it gives them some bullets too that they can fire.
You know, now that you're no longer a daily member of the State House Press Corps, mm-hmm. I'm wondering, do you think there's been a rush to judgment on this governor or not?
No, not particularly. It seems to me that Eric Greitens kind of fouled his own nest, first of all, by campaigning against corrupt career politicians, mm-hmm. and then second, once he got into office, by basically repeating that to their face. Mm-hmm. That certainly hasn't earned him any friends in the General Assembly. And that's one reason, I think, why there is such a quick reaction to all of this, demanding that he resign or demanding that impeachment proceedings begin, is because he doesn't have any friends over there in the legislature right now. And so this is something we've seen governors who had an antagonistic relationship with the General Assembly, but it's never been like this. And that's one reason it hasn't been, is because we've never had governors who served in the General Assembly who criticized the people in the legislature itself, especially those of his own party. And when you have a legislature that is two-thirds the member of your own party, and you go in with a paintbrush and paint the very broad image of them as being, as he puts it, career politicians, then you've really stirred up a hornet's nest. So
you get a sense that he doesn't have a friend of the entire joint.
Well, you know, this is a case of where you sow the wind and you reap the whirlwind. And this has come back to haunt him. And you're right. I've never heard anybody so far say that he should not step down or that he should not be impeached or this whole process is wrong. He has no defenders who've made themselves public at this stage of the game.
Bob Priddy, the former news director for the Missouri Net Radio Network in Missouri since its beginnings in 1975, is my guest. We're talking about Missouri Governor Eric Greitens. Is there any way that he can still lead this state, Bob?
I think it'll be very difficult if he's exonerated in the court and if he is not impeached before the exoneration occurs, if he's still in office after all of this happens, he still has these fences that he's torn down.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how effective he can be at all in terms of providing any kind of leadership. Now, he can continue to make appointments to boards. The Senate is going to say yes or no, these people can serve or not serve. He can continue to make speeches or he can continue to make proposals, but the legislature this year at least has shown that it's going to draft a budget and carry out a legislative package regardless of what he has said or what he has urged or what he thinks. And so the legislature's going off on its own. And I'm not too sure how effective he can be as a governor if he survives all of this. I don't think it'll be enough for him to say, well, I survived it all, so you need to pay attention to me. The only thing that he might have going for him is that there will be some new members of the General Assembly who will be elected this year, and whether they might have a better view of him than the people who are now there, we don't know. But they're certainly watching all of this, I'm sure, from wherever they are in their candidacies. And it puts many of them in an awkward position, whether he would be welcome to campaign for them, or whether they want him to campaign for them, or whether they're going to spend part of their campaign distancing themselves from him.
Mm-hmm.
By November, most of this probably will be over one way or another.
I mean, it's possible that he could be exonerated in court, mm-hmm. and still impeached through the political process that will take place in the General Assembly.
Oh, yeah. That's certainly true. And I've been thinking about this a little bit in the last few days. You know, in other places, in other systems of school districts, police departments, other governmental entities, one thing that they do, one thing they have that doesn't exist in terms of the governor and the legislative process in Jefferson City, that is that if somebody gets in trouble, well, let's just say a school teacher gets in trouble for consorting with a student, they can be suspended with or without pay while the legal system works its way through. Mm-hmm. In terms of what's going on now in Jefferson City, there's no suspension of the governor. There's no way to say, Governor, you have to leave the office and somebody will run it until you go through your court process.
And there should be such a system, you think?
Hmm?
Should there be a suspension process in place?
Well, you know, I'm not sure how that would work.
Yeah.
But at least in the terms of Eric Greitens, there is not that ingredient that a school teacher or a troubled policeman or a troubled clerk in a courthouse or something would have that option. That's the system has that option in regard to them. That's not available for a governor. And I don't know how you'd do that. Better minds than mine probably would have to work out that at the Capitol. But mm-hmm. if somebody is ruled incompetent to continue in the job, that then lets a lieutenant governor come in, and once a competence is reestablished, then the governor perhaps can take over. But right now,
sort of the Woodrow Wilson idea in the U.S. Constitution, if the president is incapacitated. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But right now, you know, if he is impeached and then removed, and then he's found not guilty of these things he's accused of doing, there are certainly grounds for impeachment consideration. If he's found not guilty, then he's out of office. He can't get that job back, mm-hmm. even though he is not guilty of the crimes he was suspected of. And so that's why impeachment, it seems to me, the request for immediate impeachment and immediate removal might be a little bit premature. That's politics.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to me that neither the House nor the Senate can remove the governor from office. Explain that to us.
Well, the way the process works in terms of a governor, and it's different from the governor and the Supreme Court judges are separate from the impeachment proceedings for other elected officials. One reason is the governor, let's just walk through this. In the case of Judy Moriarty, who was the Secretary of State that you and I both remember, was impeached, then removed from office. The House filed the charges against her, and the Supreme Court then ran the trial. In fact, I remember that the Supreme Court, which doesn't normally take witness testimony, had to have a special witness box built for the Moriarty trial. Hmm. So the House filed the charges. The Supreme Court then conducted the trial and ruled that she could not serve any longer. In the case of a governor, because the governor appoints Supreme Court judges, the Senate then steps in, and the Senate, once the House issues the charges, the Senate then appoints 7 eminent active jurists, and they will be the court that hears the impeachment charges against a governor, because that then takes the case of a governor who appoints judges to the Supreme Court, that takes it into a position where there is an isolated body that is able to rule on this case. So in the case of the governor, it will be 7 eminent jurists appointed by the Senate who will hear the case if, indeed, impeachment charges are filed by the House.
But it's still a little funky, right? Because we don't know how the Senate is going to appoint these 7 jurists. Does the pro tem do it? Do the Democrats get a couple picks? I mean, it's... That process isn't spelled out, if I understand.
I don't think it is. I've taken a cursory look at that part of the Constitution, and I don't think it is. I suspect, and again, this is just theoretical. You and I can theorize all we want to, and who knows what's going to actually happen. But I suspect that there will be a judiciary committee, for example, that will recommend 7 jurists, and then the Senate will vote whether to adopt the judiciary committee's recommendations. That's the kind of process we would likely see.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't like to speculate too much, Steve. I think there's not enough reporting, and there's too much talking.
Yeah,
in our business today, and that's one reason why the media is in such a pickle that it's in some cases in terms of public attitude, and why we're such nice political targets for certain people.
How much of a strain do you think this whole process is putting on individual members of the General Assembly?
I think there's a lot of strain on the individual members of the General Assembly. They obviously don't like Greitens, and they obviously are in a situation where if they're running for re-election, they have to weigh just what their relationship is with Greitens versus what the voters out there feel. And I think one thing that happens is, this happens to reporters as well as members of the legislature and others, is that when you're in the Capitol, and you know this, Steve, when you're in the Capitol and you're covering this stuff day by day, you become absorbed
yes.
by what's going on there.
Right.
And quite often, and I've often said when people ask me who's going to win the next election, I say, I don't know. I see these people up close and I don't know them the way voters do.
Right.
And
right.
so that's a problem people like you and I have, is that we don't really understand a lot about how Mr. and Mrs. Joe Missouri feel about the people who are in this public office. We see them up close, and we know them completely differently than the voters see them. And so it's kind of hard for us to say what mm-hmm. what the voters are going to feel. And it's hard for us to say what the legislators are dealing with when they go home and talk to the folks back home, and whether the people back home are as wrapped up in this as they are.
Right. Bob Priddy is my guest. You know, you're president, as I mentioned in the opening, of the State Historical Society of Missouri.
Yes, sir.
What are you guys working on right now?
Well, we're building a new building right across the street from the studio here in Columbia, where I'm talking to you from.
Wow.
A $35 million Center for Missouri Studies. We have a resource center there in Kansas City. It's over at UMKC, and we have resource centers at five other locations through the state of Missouri, but the main one is here in Jefferson City, and we'll be moving into our new building a year from now.
Wow.
And I hope a lot of people will be able to come in and visit with us and see this new structure, because we'll have
all kinds of
new opportunities to do things that we can't do right now. The State Historical, one of the things that we'll have is a bigger art gallery. We have one of the largest collections of Thomas Hart Benton paintings in the world.
Huh.
In our collection. We have one of the largest collections of George Caleb Bingham paintings in the world.
I didn't know this. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have, we have a collection that's valued somewhere in the nine figures.
Wow. Wow.
So that we'll have more room to display that. And it's not just, we don't just collect paintings. What we collect is the artwork that displays the history of Missouri. We have a lot of newspapers. We have 54 million pages of newspapers on microfilm. We have just about every word that Steve Kraske ever published in the Kansas City newspapers on microfilm.
Well, the state's in good hands then, isn't it, Bob?
Well, yeah. You may rest assured your legacy is preserved forever.
And yours too.
That's just one of the things we have. We just started working with the Missouri broadcasters on compiling a Missouri radio archive so that people can understand the importance of radio to the history of our state and to the culture of our state. And we hope that that people who have been in radio and are in radio are digging out all of their old tapes of programs and newscasts and special event coverage and things like that, sending it to the MBA, and it'll be housed at the State Historical Society as a radio archive so that people can hear the events that we cover and the events that we talk about in generations to come, maybe even after radio has become something completely different from what it is. They'll be able to go back and they'll be able to hear the voices of people reporting the news and hear the voices of the people in the news. So the big thing for the State Historical Society is our new building just across the street from where I am right now. We're working to find a new home for our place there in Kansas City at UMKC. And I'm not real sure where we are on that. There are a lot of balloons in the air on that particular place, but we have resource centers there and in Springfield and in St. Louis and in Rolla and Cape Girardeau. So we have the way to get our collections out to people to see things, and if you want to work with us at the State Historical Society, get in touch with our resource center at UMKC. And we can see what we can do for you and what you can do for us.
You know, just a final question I wanted to ask you, because I know this has been near and dear to your heart as well. One big concern in recent years has been the preservation of the State House in mm-hmm. Jefferson City. Where do we stand with that? Has enough money been appropriated to deal with some of the big structural problems that building faces going forward?
The answer is yes, and that's why when visitors come to Jefferson City and see the state capitol, before too long that place is going to be surrounded by scaffolding.
Mm.
They just started a couple of months ago putting up the scaffolding, because there's a lot of stonework in that historic building that is 100 years old now, and weather and time has taken its toll. And so they have started now what's going to be about a 2-year project of redoing or repairing and restoring the exterior of the Capitol, which has been out there among weather and heat and cold and all of this for 100 years now, and it's got some serious damage to it that they are going to do. But by the time of the next regular inauguration of the governor, that process on the exterior of the building should be completed. Now there's still plenty of work to do on the interior. But they did, in the latter years of the Nixon administration, they did get down in the basement and stop some very serious leaks in the basement that was causing not only water problems, but mold problems and other situations in the basement. That was another $30 million project, too. So we're restoring our building because we want it to be back in pristine condition by the time we celebrate the centennial of the dedication of the building, and that'll be in 2024.
2024. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's going to come down for that.
I absolutely would. Bob Priddy, news director of the Missouri Net for so many years. He's written books on Thomas Hart Benton and other art in the state capitol. He is president of the State Historical Society of Missouri. Bob, it is always a pleasure to have you on this show, and I sure appreciate you taking the time.
It's always fun to talk to you, Steve.
You bet. We're going to continue with this theme in our second half today, talking about the importance of Preservation Week and what it means, even for folks listening at home, things they can preserve around the house for future generations to come. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week, we talked with some Kansas City students walking out of their classrooms to call attention to gun violence in schools. You can hear that conversation in all of our previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, lead exposure and the myriad of health consequences that it can have aren't just a thing of the past. We talk with experts about the exposure rates in our neighborhoods and what can be done about it. Well, welcome to National Preservation Week. Bet you didn't know it was Preservation Week, but maybe you should know something about it. One thing worth knowing is that there are 630 million items in libraries and museums across the country that require immediate care and attention. If they don't get that attention and care, they may be lost forever to future generations. Here at UMKC, efforts continue to preserve both sound and paper that contain interviews and oral histories and handwritten manuscripts, and so many other items. Here to talk about the challenges of preserving and housing these historical records are Lindsay Shetler. She's head of special collections at the Miller Nichols Library. And Lindsay, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having us, Steve.
Derek Long is head of the Marr Sound Archives at UMKC. Derek, good morning to you as well.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, Preservation Week didn't begin until 2010, but how long has Miller Nichols been collecting and saving history, Lindsay?
For Labuddy Special Collections, it was officially established in 2002.
And has that been long enough to collect and preserve all the stuff you want to be collecting and preserving?
No, not at all.
Yeah. How much of a backlog do you have?
We have quite a backlog, but not too bad. It's enough to keep my job for a while.
Yeah. So your backlog is part of these 630 million items across the country that need to be preserved at some point down the road.
Yes.
Okay. You know, I'm wondering too, Derek, you know, how long is the Preservation Week commemorated here at UMKC, and what's on the agenda this week?
Well, this is actually the first time that we have recognized Preservation Week.
And lots of parties going on here. This is going to get pretty wild, right?
Oh, yeah.
You talk Preservation Week, you talk wild stuff, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But we're going to be putting up every day this week an aspect of preservation on the Miller Nichols webpage. So we would like everybody to go and check that out. But this is the first year that we'll actually be putting up and recognizing Preservation Week.
What's going to go up on the website today? Did you know?
It's a basic intro, and there's going to be some pictures of a flood that happened in the library, and because that is one aspect of preservation is disaster preparedness. So
because libraries and floods don't go hand in hand.
No,
very
they
well,
do not
they?
Go hand in hand at all. But if you'd like to see some pictures of a flood in the library, we have some up today.
How bad was it?
I wasn't here at the time it happened, so this happened several years ago. But for the Marr Sound Archives, Luckily, none of our actual materials got wet, but...
Because you guys were upstairs then, weren't you? Or...
No, we were in the basement, the flood happened on the first floor, and it came down to the ground floor. And
it always does.
Yeah, of course. And some of the water got on our audio equipment, unfortunately, but we were able to... It wasn't too bad, so we were able to salvage.
You know, Derek, maybe the million-dollar question here, why is it so important to preserve this stuff? I mean, people need to wrap their arms around this idea, I think.
Sure. It's important because the items or the information that is held on these items are very important to our culture and our history, and it informs and gives context to the past and to the time periods that the items were created. And as far as big picture, I mean— We as humans,
we sort of base our history and our collective culture on the things that we preserve, right? It's how we're remembered at one point.
Right, right. And basically everyone who's become before us, you know, they have built, you know, our society. And so we need to preserve those items into the future so we can continue to build.
Yeah. What would you add to that, Lindsay?
Yeah. So from a paper preservation standpoint, we've been documenting our experiences and our thoughts for centuries now. And so being able to look back and understand life through those documents is really important. And then being able to create accessibility and discoverability around those so that we can then interpret and continue to build upon them.
Yeah, I can't help but think that your job has just become exponentially, doesn't even get to it, so much more difficult in the era of the internet. Now, we not only have paper and radio and records and LPs and all these things, but now you're looking at this endless amount of material that's online. How do you begin to pick and choose and decide which of those materials and items are worth preserving, and how do you preserve those things?
Yeah, so for preserving the material, it kind of goes in four stages. So when we are looking at the material to preserve, we have to think about preserving the material itself. So understanding what the material is made from. So for paper, is it made out of wood pulp from the 19th century or earlier, or is it made out of cotton rags from an earlier time period?
Which, different method of preservation is needed for both of those things.
Yeah. And then bringing in preventive conservation, so being able to stabilize the material. And then we go on to the next step of preserving the content on the material. So we want to gain the intellectual control of the content and be able to make that accessible so that people can understand what we have and use it for research. And nowadays, we have two more components to that, which is... being able to reformat it or digitize the material so that it's even more accessible rather than just locally or having to come in to view the material. We can now see it online.
Well, how do you begin to grapple with the internet when there's so much information online now that may not necessarily be in paper form?
Yeah.
I feel for you guys because that job sounds like hard.
Yeah, and it's kind of... prioritizing based upon what our users need at UMKC, what our scope of our collections are. So Kansas City, we're collecting local history as well. So we want to prioritize those things first. And then also from there, it depends on the fragility of the material. Mm-hmm. So is it at a point where we need to digitize this now or we're going to lose it? And Derek can talk more to that with audiovisual. Mm-hmm. And so once we are able to do that, then we have two copies of it. One is digital and one is physical.
I was going to say, do you have the storage capacity you need for digital content?
That is kind of out of my area of expertise,
okay. Yeah.
For sure.
Okay. How about the sound stuff? Derek, how do you wrap your arms around preserving all the different forms of sound that come in all kinds of different ways?
Yeah, the issue with sound is that some of the formats are deteriorating rapidly. So we're not talking about vinyl LPs and 78 RPMs. They're relatively stable. So we're more concerned about things like lacquer disc, open reel tapes, cassette tape, really any tape, magnetic tape at all.
Cassette tapes?
Yeah,
cassette. And they don't last forever, right? That magnetic quality doesn't go on forever.
Right, right. And you know, part of the problem is the binder and how they are stored. You know, they can get sticky and the tape will get sticky and won't play. So that's one of the issues. So how we preserve that content is we digitize it. That's the first step of preservation. And we do that because these formats, they're not going to last forever. We can slow down the process of degradation, but we can't stop it. So the only way to get the content off of the item is to change it to a different medium, and that is a digital medium.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first step of preservation. But as you'd mentioned, the digital stuff, that continues. So the point I like to make is that nothing is actually preserved. We're just in the act of preserving it. So that's digital preservation. We have to continue to preserve things over time mm-hmm. because we want it to be available far in the future.
Because digital formats could change down the road, and that could get tricky too, right?
Yeah, that's another aspect of digital preservation we have to be very conscious of. For audio, we use the WAV file format. I'm hopeful that it'll continue to be around. It's universally accepted.
Yeah,
it's an archival standard. It's a standard in the audio community. So I'm very hopeful it'll be around. But that is something we have to be conscious of, especially for other file format types, because there's often digital formats that, you know, have gone by the wayside. Like, I don't know if anybody remembers WordPerfect files for, you know, text, but
yeah.
It's like, you know, some of these files aren't being supported anymore, and we have to keep that in mind.
What are some of the rarest recordings you have at the Marsound Archives that you've worked to preserve in recent years? I mean, things you're really worried about how fragile they were when you actually made the transfer to digital.
Sure. Our top priority right now is lacquer disc, and for people who don't know, it looks like a vinyl LP, but for the most part, they're aluminum cores that are wrapped in lacquer, and when they were recorded, they would actually cut the sound directly into the disc, and they are very fragile, so we're really trying to preserve those. That's our top priority, and just recently, we preserved some that were of Charlie Parker in New York, and I'm sure plenty of your listeners know that Charlie Parker's a Kansas City native and godfather of bebop, and we had some original recordings of him at Birdland in New York. And
from what year?
1948.
So that's really early in his,
yeah.
You know, he's into bebop by then, but he's really into it. And what kind of shape were the recordings you were working with? The original recordings?
Well, they had some palmitic acid on it, and that's the problem with the lacquer disc, is this palmitic acid builds up on it. It's a fatty acid, and it actually makes the lacquer break down and actually chip off of the disc. But they had palmitic acid, but it hadn't began chipping yet, so we were able to clean that off and preserve the items.
You played on a conventional phonograph player to digitize it?
Well, we do. We have a custom-made phonograph or turntable, and it can play anything from a 5-inch disc to a 16-inch disc. And we have to use different styli because over time, people would use different cutting lathes on these lacquer discs, and the cutting lathes would be of different sizes, so we'd have to use a different styli, or maybe listeners might know it better as like a needle for the turntable, but they're different sizes, and we're trying to get into the groove to get the best sound possible out of the groove, so we have to change out the styli and actually listen by ear to get the best quality out of the recording.
Is that kind of an exciting moment for a preservationist to actually listen to a 1948 Charlie Parker recording that's as rare as this one is?
Oh, definitely. It was very exciting for us. And
I bet Chuck Jaddix was all.
Oh, yeah. He's super excited about it.
Yeah. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking this morning about Preservation Week and what's involved with that and the importance of preserving materials for future generations to come. You know, let's offer some advice to listeners before I let this get away from me, who might be concerned about saving personal items and wondering what's worth saving for even people outside of immediate families and what's not. Lindsay, when it comes to paper, you know, say a family scrapbook, what guidance can you offer that people might want to think about to best preserve those kinds of things going forward?
Yeah, so there's a few things you want to watch out for, which is mold, water, and pests. and fluctuating temperatures. So not storing things in the attic or in the basement, keeping it on the main floor, maybe away from light, so in a closet. Also think about putting all of your paper material and photographs in plastic bins so that it is protected from the environment, the surrounding environment, for pests can't really get into plastic compared to boxes. And then I would also say to separate highly acidic paper. So separate out the newspapers from photographs. Keep all the like material together. So keep photographs together, keep newspapers together, but keep those separate in different containers.
How often do people call you and say, hey, I've got this. You know, is it worth preserving? Do you guys want it? I mean, do you get those calls a lot?
Generally, I don't, at least not yet at UMKC, because I'm fairly new.
Right.
But I know Stuart Hines gets them fairly regularly.
People are wondering what they've got.
Yeah.
Derek, how about when it comes to sound, what can we do to preserve old recordings that may have, that may be on like cassette tape or old LPs or whatever?
Sure. I mean, there are some things you could do yourself. Cassette tapes, that's not too difficult to do. As far as the lacquer disc, if you do have some of these lacquer discs, and we do get calls from the people in the community that do have them, we do suggest that you bring them to a professional just because of the things I had mentioned before about the different styli, and there's actually different EQ standards and things like that that have to be taken into account. So in some cases, you really do need to go to a professional to have those digitized.
Are there professionals here in town?
There are some, and we do that occasionally where we will work with a community member to digitize their materials.
And what about cassette tapes?
We digitize cassette tapes, and I would say cassette tapes is probably one of the analog materials that you could probably get away with doing it pretty cheaply on your own.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because basically all you need is a cassette deck and an analog to digital converter in your computer, and you can do that work.
If our listeners want to chime in with questions about personal things they may have, they're wondering about how to preserve, give us a call, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. What old technology do you have to keep on hand to be able to preserve sound to current digital forms, Derek?
Well, we have to have our turntable. We have a few of the turntables that I had mentioned before that were custom made, and we can play any disc with those. We also...
Custom-made turntables?
Yeah, the issue with turntables is most people are used to like the basic 12-inch LP, but we have about 30,000 16-inch discs, which were used in radio broadcasting. So that's a very high priority for us, and we need those custom-made turntables in order to play those materials back and digitize them. Other types of equipment that we need reel-to-reel tapes because we have, or reel-to-reel machines because we have quite a few reel-to-reel tapes, cassette decks, digital audio tape or DATs. We don't really do A-track. We do mini disc. Trying to think of some of the cylinders. Of course, we actually don't digitize cylinders, but we do have playback equipment for cylinders.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, you know, a lot of little odd and in things that we get that come in, like wire recordings and things like that, which we have players for those, but we also don't digitize wire recordings either.
You know, Lindsay, you said you haven't been here real long, but do you have other personal favorite things in the collection that have come across your plate, things that you really get a kick out of looking at?
Yeah, so one that I like to use in instruction, especially with freshmen and sophomores, introducing them to special collections, is wrapping their heads around what kind of material we have and how you can use it in your research.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those is a piece of ephemera, which is a train ticket from the 20s. And on the back of the train ticket, it is kind of captures a snapshot of women's oppression. It says, for women to please do your shopping early so that men can get on the train after work and have room to be on the train.
Wow.
And so I use that as an example to show that
used to be a little different. Yeah.
Things used to be a little different. And it was a piece of small paper that was a ticket that normally you think to throw away, but something that can show kind of that time period.
Yeah. We go to a phone call here. Edward from Kansas City, Missouri. We're talking about Preservation Week. Edward, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I have some newspapers that I laminated about 30 years ago, and I was wondering if what's the deterioration prospect of that? I mean, how is it going to deteriorate? I mean, is it a good idea to laminate old newspapers?
That's a great question. Everybody's got old newspapers around the house, yeah.
Yeah, so with laminating, lamination usually has a adhesive within it, so that can actually speed up deterioration due to the chemicals that are binding between the adhesive and the acidic paper. So what I usually recommend is to not laminate. If you can encapsulate, which is basically using archival quality plastic, which is polypropylene, and you can buy that in sleeves where you can sleeve your newspapers, or just leaving your newspapers together, laying flat in an acid-free box will keep them from, at least slow the rate of deterioration. But there is nothing that we can ever do to actually stop the deterioration.
You know, we got a new motto for Preservation Week that you just mentioned. Don't laminate, encapsulate, right?
Yes.
Edward, I hope that helps.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You might lose some stuff there, Edward, it sounds like.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay. How old are your newspapers?
They're about 50 years old.
Okay.
I would recommend getting them digitized, so at least you have the content there to preserve.
I see. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, Edward. Good luck. We were talking about favorite parts, personal favorite parts of the different collections you guys work with. And Derek, what's yours?
Let's see. Favorite part of the collection?
Yeah.
I particularly like the radio broadcast, especially like the local radio broadcast.
Yeah.
And
a lot of Walt Bodine in there?
There is a lot of Walt Bodine, for sure.
Yeah.
We have the Walt Bodine collection, actually.
Mm-hmm.
We also have like these little interesting like commercial radio spots. So we have also have the Ed Roche collection, and he was a local audio engineer. And so he recorded everybody who would come through town and a lot of the businesses in town. And then he even had recordings of, you know, Harry Truman and Harry Truman's daughter, you know, playing piano. So there's a lot
that
of
Harry
like
once had to famously defend to a New York critic,
yes.
I think.
Yes.
Got them all upset. Yeah.
So there's some interesting things in there, but that's probably my favorite thing is listening to the old radio programs.
Do you have to have the items in the collections and archive appraised for insurance purposes? Are they worth that much that you've taken that step?
People do. It has to be over $5,000, I believe, and you have to have it appraised if it's going to be worth over $5,000.
We've got a few things that might fit that category.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, some of these collections that we get are huge. I mean, we've gotten collections that are, you know, 10,000 really rare disc.
And you're behind in keeping up, trying to get them all preserved, as we talked about in the opening, all these millions of items that haven't been preserved yet.
Right, that's correct.
Yeah, okay. We'll leave our conversation there about Preservation Week. I want to thank Lindsay Shetler, head of special collections at the Miller Nichols Library. Derek Long is head of the Mar Sound Archives. Thank you both very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Enjoy Preservation Week. Don't get too crazy now, okay? On Friday, we met a few local kids who walked out of school as part of the national protest against violence in schools. Find out what they were hoping to accomplish. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at 30 years of AIDS activism in Kansas City. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.